Welcome to Awakened Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Preeta, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awakening Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it's with ourselves or with others. Across time and culture, stories have been agents of personal and social transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of these weekly calls is to share stories from incredible changemakers from around the globe. Through guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all our listeners for helping to co-create this space. Today, we are grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Sarah Payton, whose personal journey is not only inspiring, but is having a tremendous impact on many people. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let's start with just a moment of silence to anchor ourselves in the space. Welcome again to our weekly Awakening Call. Today, we're in conversation with Sarah Payton. In just a few minutes, our remarkable moderator, Aria, will engage in a deep dialogue with Sarah. And around the top of the hour, we'll roll into a circle of sharing where we invite all of your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicebase.org. That's ask@servicebase.org. This week's theme is really about kind of the riddle of self-esteem and why self-compassion can be hard. Sarah is a remarkable individual to share her story with us in that regard. And we have the great pleasure of having Aria as our moderator today. For those of you who don't know Aria, Aria's had a long career in the human development and human capital sector. He's been involved in guiding a number of corporations in their human development strategies. So Aria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Preeta. I'd like to introduce Sarah. Sarah Payton is a certified trainer in the Center for Nonviolent Communication. She has a passion for weaving together neuroscience knowledge on the one hand, with experiences that unify people and their brains and their bodies. She aims to integrate the teachings from brain science with the use of resonant language to help heal trauma, based on her belief that language is a starting point for a movement towards self-warmth. Sarah offers healing experiences using precision and resonant language that have come alive to her through her long-term study of nonviolent communication, together with explorations of families over generations. Once we start learning about neuroscience, Sarah says, we find out how emotional trauma creates self-blame and isolation and gets in the way of gentleness with the self. We humans are uniquely vulnerable to emotional harm, but we're also uniquely available to hold each other and ourselves with warmth and resonance in ways that reestablish real relationship and engage our brain's capacity for healing. Sarah teaches and lectures internationally. A few years ago, three friends came along and said, Sarah, we want a book, and we want you to write it, and we're going to support you to do that. Sarah felt that, quote, the thought of spending time alone with my brain in a writing process was a little scary. Her friends told her they'd spend time on the phone with her in conversation about what she was teaching, and they would take notes, and together they would turn them into chapters and into a book. And the result was her book, Your Resonant Self, Guided Meditations and Exercises to Engage Your Brain's Capacity for Healing, which was published just 4 months ago by Norton Publishing. Sarah hopes that we can use warm language to support and accompany ourselves and that our brain can grow and heal at any age, increasing our resilience and enjoyment of life. In her work, Sarah draws from her own personal experiences. She says, I used to struggle with brutal depression, deadening, heavy sadness that made it hard to muster the energy to take a shower or even brush my teeth. Back then, I was in a constant battle with savagely self-critical inner voice that told me I was worthless, stupid, and unlovable. I didn't realize that my depression made so much sense, given my childhood experiences of family that didn't support warm, nurturing relationships. I'm here today to share what I've learned since then about how to heal past pains and move into a joyful relationship with ourselves. Regardless of your age, genetic predisposition, or adverse childhood experiences, your brain is capable of building new neural fibers to help self-regulate your emotions and awaken your body as a place of safety and security. Wow. So, Sarah Payton, thank you so much for joining us this morning, or this evening, depending on where in the world we're listening from. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Okay. So, here's the first thing. I'd like to start with this question. Your work has really involved the creative marriage of two kinds of things, of neuroscience knowledge on the one hand and guided meditation exercise and other exercises that offer people the chance to heal and rewire their brains. This is not exactly a standard major in universities. So could you share with us a little about your journey and what brought you to this particular work?
Yes, thank you so much. I had the experience, as you mentioned in your beautiful introduction of me, you mentioned that I came from a place of a real struggle, and the inside of my own brain was not a friendly place. It was a little like trying to turn toward myself with warmth was a little bit like being Edward Scissorhands. So that was my starting point, was a kind of self-lacerating capacity for criticism and just a real longing for the invulnerability that I thought perfection would bring, undoable though that request was to myself. So I stumbled across nonviolent communication when Marshall Rosenberg was still alive and still traveling and teaching. And I had the extraordinary experience of bringing something very difficult, very entrenched. We had adopted a son, and I was having a really hard time hugging him. And it just seemed like I was going to be doomed to living with the shame and horror of my own limitations mm-hmm. for the rest of my life, and letting down this beautiful soul who had come to live in our family. And as I sat in a circle of people who were practicing nonviolent communication with me, which is a modality of language use where we're not giving anybody advice, which is quite extraordinary in North America, the tendency to tell other people how to live their lives when they are in some sort of emotional pain is really overwhelmingly tempting here.
Yeah.
So for the first time in my life, I was being received by people who were genuinely wondering what was happening for me. How did this make sense? This is the beautiful question I think that nonviolent communication asks and answers: is how do our understood behaviors and words make sense? What are the deep messages? So people were catching me in that way, and I experienced a complete transformation. I had a actual kind of visceral and physical memory of reaching out towards my mother and feeling her body recoil.
Oh, wow.
In that moment, my inability to hug my beautiful child fell away from me, and I was able, after that, to hug him. So this was extraordinary and so sweet to me, and I am a person who loves to know why things work. So I plunged into the new world of relational, cognitive, and social neuroscience that was coming out of all of the universities that had purchased fMRI machines and started to figure out how to try to use them to see what the human brain does in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to start to dig into neuroscience. I'm not a neuroscience degree person. I've become a neuroscience educator and speaker and writer because your average neuroscientist is deeply immersed in their own field of inquiry and their own way of seeing the brain, and there are many different ways to see the brain, all of which are so helpful. So I have become a synthesist and a communicator between our brains, which are hard to access from the outside unless we begin to take and integrate this knowledge, and our hearts. So here we are, you know, we have these certain mammalian tendencies inside of these hard skulls of ours, and we have our, you know, very delicious and loving hearts. And how do we create the connection between the two?
How do we create the connection between the brains and the hearts? You know, you said something, Sarah, that kind of intrigued me, that one of the early things you learned from the Center for Nonviolent Communication is that this makes sense.
Yeah.
Can you explain more about that? Unpack that a little bit?
Sure. The way that nonviolent communication looks at people acting in the world is that everything we do is in service of very deep and universal needs. That we have longings for connection, and we want the well-being of the people we love. So, for example, the women on my father's side of the family are round, and the women on my mother's side of the family are elegant and slender. So, my mother received me as a daughter, and I was round. And it was very hard and distressing for her. And she spent years saying, "Oh, you're fat, you're fat."
Yeah.
And this was difficult to receive, as you can imagine. And so I spent a number of years when I was first becoming involved with nonviolent communication working with the amount of distress I experienced when I was with my mom. And I got to a point where one day, I had been held by many people who loved me and said, "Yes, your response of horror and shame makes sense." They said this so often that my mother said to me, "You're fat." And I turned to her and I said, "Mom, I wonder if when you see my body, if you get so worried about my long-term well-being and my health." And she said, "Yes."
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, and then
you turned that whole around.
Yes, yes. And this is kind of where we go with the language between people. And then, of course, I became so interested in how do we speak to ourselves? And how do we begin to hear ourselves in this very way? Like when we're beating ourselves up, what happens if we say to that voice, internal voice of Sarah, "Are you so worried about her well-being? Do you really want her success? Do you truly believe that perfection is the only way to be safe? It creates a very different internal brain environment that becomes progressively more and more warm and welcoming for ourselves.
I think, Sarah, you've just asked another question that I've been wanting to ask you, and that question is, how does being warmer and kinder to ourselves reflect out in our ability to be kinder out in the world? I think you just gave me a beautiful example of that.
Oh, yeah. Certainly. It's a very interesting dilemma that we as North Americans and probably Western Europeans live in. I've traveled somewhat in the global South and in the East, but I'm most familiar with our Western kind of ways of thinking, and we tend to really emphasize with our little children from their very earliest days that they should turn their attention and their warmth outward. That they should take care of other people, that they should share their toys, that they should be thoughtful, that they should apologize, that they should, you know, I mean, it's a constant stream of encouraging people to look outward rather than inward in this very interesting way where we're asking people to come in their warmth and compassion for others to come from an unrooted place, to come from an intentionality that is not so deeply rooted in the body. You know, we don't teach our children how to root compassion deeply in the body. And so when the compassion is deeply rooted in connection for self and in our own physical experience of warmth for others, it is quite it brings an authenticity and humility, you know, to the experience of having compassion for others. So it makes it even richer and deeper than it ever was before.
That's very interesting. I as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of memories both from my childhood and from my parenthood when my kids were young, where the type of message that happened between parent and child was something like, don't be so selfish. Share your toys.
Yes.
Yeah. And from your perspective, what would a healthier message be to the child?
A healthier message would be, it's a very interesting and deep movement for parents with their children. There's a movement into an understanding of the child. It's quite difficult sometimes to put into words, but for example, in the very simple act of sharing a toy, there would be an entire conversation that would be appreciating the child and the child's heart. I had the experience once with a little guy who killed a spider and started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to guess what was happening for this little person. Were they sad that they had killed the spider? They were, but it didn't make them stop crying. Yeah. Were they mad at themselves for killing the spider? A little bit, but it didn't make them stop crying. It didn't, you know, bring them to a place of like relief. And I wondered and wondered, and finally I said to this little person who was about 8 years old, I said, in the moment when you killed that spider, I wonder if you were devastated by a sudden sense of fragility about life itself.
Ah.
And he said, yes. And he stopped crying.
Wow.
These are the lives of children. The inner lives of children are so much bigger than we ever imagined, because we had to turn away from our little ones, the little ones that we were, and we have forgotten the enormous hearts that we came into this life with.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm just imagining, going back to my question about the the alternate approach to don't be so selfish, share your toys, might be that I might be, as a parent, I might be saying to the child something about, it must be scary to think about letting go of this toy, and maybe it might disappear. I might say something like that. Yeah.
Oh, very interesting. That's a wonderful guess.
Yeah.
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 Another guess, too, can be about the enormous amount of love that the child has for their toy. Sometimes that can be true, too. And sometimes there can be other things as well. Children's brains, you know, shift and move and change as they grow, and there are different developmental stages that have to do with whether other people exist and whether the toy will exist when it's gone, like you said, you know, will it come back, and all kinds of interesting things that have to do with brains and objects. And
now, shifting environments, my understanding is that one of the things you've done at the Center for Nonviolent Communication is you taught your process with a colleague at a women's prison. Is that true?
Yes, I've spent 10 years going into a women's prison. And in the beginning, I just brought in nonviolent communication once a week as a volunteer with another beloved colleague named Deb Solheim. And we had the incredible honor of being able to work with these women and to bring in the neuroscience. They were so interested in the neuroscience.
Really?
My book is actually dedicated in part to these women who really, with their interest and passion, invited me to move ever more deeply into the integration of nonviolent communication and relational neuroscience. They loved it. I often have the interesting experience of people who are studying with me or in, you know, lectures with me coming up to me and saying, how do you talk about this when the people that you're talking to are not educated?
Yeah.
And I say, actually, people who are not educated are remarkably forgiving of geeks. And I didn't change the way I was teaching at all, really. I just stayed with what I was doing. I made explanations of the big, you know, brain words, and we just dove right in. They were so fascinated and interested. Passion and curiosity overcome everything.
How did you get invited in there in the first place?
I barged in. It somehow really spoke to me, and I found a volunteer program that was going in and rode in on their coattails and continued to be with them. I've actually shifted what I do because I travel so much now. I can't do weekly classes with them. So now I go in once every quarter with a group of eight or so volunteers, and we do this other modality that you mentioned in passing, kind of in your introduction, which is family constellation work. I take family constellation work into the prison.
Could you give us an example or two of what happened with someone in the women's prison after being introduced to your material and
mm-hmm.
how that affected them?
Yes, absolutely. There have been very powerful experiences of the prison that I work in also has a number of very sweet spiritually based programs, and the women often combine their work in nonviolent communication with their spiritual practices and growth. And so I don't want to take full credit for anything, because there are others who also come in and contribute so much to the women in prison. But in conjunction with other offerings, some very remarkable things happened. There have For example, there have been people who heard voices, who, you know, were clinically diagnosed as schizophrenic, who have had a great reduction in the kind and number of voices that they hear. One person had heard some very cruel voices, and over the years that they have been in connection with this material, they shifted to hearing just one neutral voice. So I believe that there's such profound movement. Many women have gone from believing that they are stupid to beginning to understand the effects of childhood trauma on the brain and the way in which it impacts our ability to learn and to function inside of classrooms. So huge amounts of self-forgiveness. There was also a woman who had the experience. She came in and she said, "I was talking to the officer, you know, I think it was a parole officer, a probation officer or something. And she said, I was talking to this officer and I got so mad at them, I wanted to launch myself across the table and smash them with my fist. And she said, and then I remembered you, Sarah, and I remembered your hand, and one of the things I do is to do Daniel Siegel's Brain in the Palm of the Hand, where you use the hand as a model for the brain, and you show a fist closed gently around the thumb being the brain that's regulated. And then you open your hand and you show the thumb tucked into the palm, but the fingers are straight out, and this is not regulated. We have flipped our lid here. So in the experience of flipping the lid, then you don't have any control. So traditionally, what this woman had done is she had launched herself physically against people she was angry at. And she said, I thought of you, Sarah, and I thought of your hand going up and down, and I couldn't remember whether my fist was supposed to be closed or open, but it didn't matter because I didn't launch myself across the table. And I was able, for the first time in my life, to have a choice about how I was responding.
Wow.
Yeah. And she said, I have been through 10 anger management classes, and this is the first time I've seen a result. So that was quite an extraordinary story.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm curious if, you know, you travel a lot, you speak, you do workshops. Is there another particular environment where you were that is, you know, was especially interesting to you that you'd like to share a little bit about with us?
I really love, one of the things I love the most is traveling and speaking in small or large auditoriums and having people come up to me at the end of the conversation and say, ah, I make sense. I never thought that I made sense. And now I see that I make sense. Yeah, all of the things we learn about the brain are so supportive of well-being. You know, the understanding that when we're born, we're actually hardwired for alarm to take over our bodies. We come out all wired up for alarm to run us.
For alarm?
Yeah.
Is that a survival kind of thing?
Absolutely. And the early experiences we have of being met with warmth and resonance start to grow and sort of softwire our brains for self-understanding and self-compassion, and self-esteem. It's like when we make sense, we have easy access to self-esteem. So, for example, this is from the research of Beatrice Beebe, who is a New York City researcher who's extraordinary. She has done 4 decades of research where she's looking at the facial expressions between mothers and 4-month-old babies. And she takes a videotape, a high-definition videotape of these interactions from each angle, and then puts them side by side and looks at the micro moment by micro moment interplay of facial expressions between the mom and the baby.
Wow.
And what it turns out is that if the mom is able to reflect the baby's facial expression, so if the baby's mad, for a micro moment, the mom does a mad face, and she's like, of course you're mad. And then she goes to, you know, solving and caring for and fixing whatever the situation is. Or if the baby's really sad, then the mom does a little sad face before she goes to fixing and taking care of and resolving whatever the problem is. So there are these moments of facial expression at a micro, like at a 14th of a second this happens, where the mom is acknowledging and validating the baby's emotional experience before words ever enter the picture.
Wow.
Yeah, so these little ones then who receive this kind of responsiveness actually end up with more resilient systems for living life. When they hit moderate stress bumps, their system doesn't have to go into fight or flight to be able to survive. Instead, they kind of outsource their stress into this field that the mother has created where the baby makes sense. So the baby gets mad, but they're like, oh, I make sense. Of course I make sense. And so they don't go into the stress system. It's very interesting about the human brain that what upsets the human brain more than anything else is the worry that things don't make sense.
The worry that things don't make sense. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is our default mode is stress, things don't make sense, and then sort of the mother and baby interaction can reprogram that.
Yes, and the mother becomes a facilitator of the baby's emotional existence in this world.
When we were talking earlier, you said something. I think you said that the bulk of this kind of reprogramming happens, did you say, the first 3 or 4 months of the baby's life?
Yes, yes, it does. It happens entirely preverbally. But here's the cool thing. So, you know, I mean, then it means that the first 4 months are hugely important, of course, and the capacity of the mom to be emotionally responsive is hugely important.
Yeah.
And these babies, you know, have very good health outcomes and a deep sense of meaning in life. I mean, they're the babies, they're the little babies who got the frosting on their cupcake. For those of us whose moms were more compromised, more traumatized, coming out of childhood abuse, more dissociated, unable to respond as easily, we actually get to continue this process at whatever age we are.
Mm.
Yeah, we remain forever neuroplastic. We remain forever changeable and healable by experiences of being understood.
That is a very hopeful message.
It's so fabulous.
I'm wondering if this neuroplastic. I'm wondering if there are any studies, you know, comparably rigorous about how a person's brain responses later in life can change as a result of these kinds of interactions.
Yes, there's a gentleman who writes a lot about the neuroplastic older brain. His name is Lou Cozzolino. C-O-Z-O-L-I-N-O. He's part of the Norton series. He's been the editor the main editor of the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology.
Uh-huh.
And was actually the person who approved the publication of my book as well. And his books are very helpful for beginning to really get a sense of the way in which the older brain is a neuroplastic and responsive place.
Wow. Well, this is getting us into some of the things you talk about in your book. And I just want to ask you about some of the concepts you discuss in your book, and in a very basic questions, as being someone who's not too familiar with this neurobiology. So you speak a lot about emotional warmth. And what exactly do you, I mean, you know, intuitively I kind of know what that means, but can you say in a little more detail what is emotional warmth?
Yeah. Emotional warmth is when we get to experience a bodily sense of being held in a way that's just right for us. Not necessarily physically held, but emotionally responded to, or even sometimes there's a way that we can be intellectually responded to that gives us a sense of being appreciated and held with affection. The experience of emotional warmth, sometimes it can be a little iffy if we've never really had, if humans have been dangerous, then our nervous systems will be on alarm around humans.
Mm.
And it might be difficult to have experiences where we really have a sense of being held with warmth. If that is so, then one of the things we can do is to notice, first of all, to notice how we might feel about some, like maybe a kitten or a puppy or the colt of a horse, or a baby might be non-threatening enough that we would feel warmth for the baby. So the first question is, are there any entities, human or non-human, that we have a sense of affection for? And then to notice what happens in our body when we're in the presence of the little one, whatever, the little one, or even sometimes people become really connected to trees or to landscape or to plants in general or to birds. And so people will often find other ways to be in a love relationship with the world, even if humans are not trustworthy.
Yeah.
And so if we think about what we love the most, do we love a landscape the most? Do we love a tree the most? Do we love a baby? Do we love a kitten? Just to notice what happens in our body. You know, often it's a sense in the heart area of a softening, of a kind of a glow. So that's one starting point for investigating emotional warmth. Because if we can feel it for others, then it's a matter of habit that we don't know how to turn it inwards. It's like we have to learn to turn that flashlight beam of whatever kind of love it is that we're experiencing. We kind of have to learn to turn it around and aim it at ourselves. And what's so interesting about that is that over and over again when I work with people, they will say, I can't love myself, I hate myself. And I'm like, oh, did you always hate yourself? And they go, yes. And I go, okay, did you hate yourself when you were 3? And they go, yes. And I say, okay, did you hate yourself when you're a baby, when you're an infant? And they go, no. And I say, okay, what happened between when you were a baby and when you were 3 years old? And often there is something that happened. Another sibling was born.
Hmm.
Or a mother died, or a grandmother was in a terrible car accident. All kinds of things will happen that interrupt the flow of love. We'll have trauma. Trauma, when it happens, creates fault lines in the human brain that prevent the flow of love. And so oftentimes, you know, we'll get this answer, oh, you know, a sibling was born, or, oh, I went to school and had a scary teacher, or, oh, my grandmother died. You know, whatever it is, then as we bring warmth and precise understanding of the emotional experience that our little one had, then then the sense of not being able to like the self disappears. If we don't like ourselves, it is the result of one of these fault lines of trauma that prevents the connection of the circuits of warmth with the self.
So you're saying that the external relationship then becomes internalized.
Yes, the external relationship becomes internalized, or we are unbearable to ourselves. Our pain is too great.
Yeah.
And we aren't able to hold it, and so we kind of, a fault line appears between self and self.
Also, I noticed that the way you define this is that emotional warmth is when we're responded to in the way that's just right.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that there could be instances where someone might think they're being very warm to someone else, but they're doing it in a way that isn't just right and might have the wrong effect.
That's why I always combine warmth and precision. People think that's a very strange conversation.
No,
what the heck are you doing, sir? Yeah.
Oh, I had the experience one time I was walking with someone who had just been feeling very hurt and was crying, and there was someone in the street who looked at us and said, "Oh, have a wonderful evening, you two," and with a big smile.
Yeah.
When the effect was just the opposite, it made everything even worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I want to move on to another concept in your book. What is resonance, and what is resonance skill?
Resonance is, so first of all, let's start with the concept of attunement. And
okay.
Attunement is where we kind of let our own being focus on another person with warm curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And a wondering about how it is for them to be themselves. And so in that experience, it's like we can attune to anyone, even if they're not attuning back to us. So we can wonder with warmth about anybody on the planet. And we can, and it doesn't matter whether or not they have a sense, you know, that we understand them. It's the attitude and the intention of bringing ourselves into a wondering about another. Then once we begin to enter relational space, and we kind of can check that out, and the other person says, "Yes, that is how I feel. That is how it is for me." Then we start to enter the resonance space, the resonance field. So I often use the metaphor of cellos, because I, at the age of 50, started to play the cello, which had been a lifelong dream. I am still not very good at it, partly because I travel so much, and you cannot travel with a cello unless you are Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh, that's hard, yeah.
So, but I still love it. So anyway, if you have a cello that you are playing, and you have a cello that's not being played right next to it, and you put your ear to the cello that's not being played, you will hear that it is vibrating and toning very softly with the music that's being played on the cello that's you know, being used for music. And so what we do as humans, without even knowing it, we are resonant beings. We do resonate with one another. And as we, you know, open that channel for, "Is this what it's like for you?" And the other person says, "Yes," or, "No, that's not what it's like for me. This is what it's like for me." And we go, "Oh, that's what it's like for you." Then this interplay begins to happen where we're in a dyad that is resonant, where someone is being understood. Of course, the sweetest thing is when we get to kind of both be understood. But oftentimes, as we're doing this healing work, we need to have the focus be on us so that we get into a place where we're with somebody who's understanding us and we're just letting ourselves be resonated with. It's very powerful and supportive.
Mm. So emotional warmth is sort of like I can shine emotional warmth on anyone regardless of how they respond. And then it progresses to resonance when there's some sort of response where we're going back and forth and relating to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So another thing you talk about in your book is how important language is.
Mm-hmm.
And the role of language in all this. Can you say a little bit about this? Why is language so important, and how is it important?
Mm-hmm. I often think that we as humans have a lot in common with neurons inside of the brain.
Humans have a lot in common with neurons?
Yes.
Okay.
So, for example, when neurons are communicating, they are not actually touching each other. They're sending packets of neurotransmitters and neurochemicals and neurohormones from one neuron to the other.
Uh-huh.
And the kind of information that's packaged in those little packets is very important for what happens next. So the neurons don't know each other. They have to receive communication from one another.
Uh-huh.
And it's also true for humans. You're encased in a particular body, and I'm encased in a particular body. And what allows us, especially now, when we don't get to be person to person, but we're on the phone with each other, is that I'm sending packets from my, you know, being to your being. So it's very important what's in the packet that I'm sending from my being to your being. And it's very important that I'm taking in what you're asking and responding in some way to what you're asking so that our communication is contingent, so that there is both acknowledgement of what you're asking or what you're saying, and then there's whatever I'm adding or bringing in response to your question.
Hmm.
So it's a sort of a beautiful question to ask when we're on the phone with these packets of connection and information flowing between us. What is the importance of words?
So the role of language is, from my understanding of what you're saying, is to sort of tune the back and forth of what's going on and how are we syncing up with each other.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. One thing occurred to me as I was thinking about this conversation, Sarah, that there are so many issues, big social issues today, and at this time when we're living in, that it seems like what you teach and what you do is relevant. And I just want to throw out one of them and see any reflections you might have. The whole issue of the Me Too moment now and the sexual harassment and all the stories that are coming out about that. From your point of view and what you teach, how do you see, you know, the role of what you've learned from neuroscience in, you know, playing out in this kind of issue?
This is such a wonderful question for me because I've been thinking deeply about this since it began. I think what we're really in the presence of is a long habit of not seeing other people as existing.
Hmm.
The left hemisphere of the brain, left to its own devices, it has a different cortical structure than the right hemisphere of the brain. Much shorter neural connections. The neurons in the left hemisphere are much more arranged in rows and columns, so while the right hemisphere actually has more neural matter in it because it has longer arms that are able to encompass the big picture and to understand that other people are souls, that other people are infinite beings, to be able to begin to imagine that every person we meet has 86 billion neurons. I mean, we're infinite for all intents and purposes. There are trillions of neural connections that our brains are making. We are not some easily categorizable and objectifiable, you know, function. We are people. And a part of what we've been living with in some way and is throughout really all over the globe in so many societies is a long objectification of each gender by each other.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, because women have had less power, the objectification of women by men has had very frightening consequences,
yeah.
life-destroying consequences. And I often think about the men who have done this to the women. For those men, those women are not human souls. You know, those women are some kind of, you know, function that fulfills their desire for sexual expression or something. There's not a sense of the other person really existing. And it feels to me like what we're moving toward is throughout all of these very important movements right now, the whole LGBTQ, you know, movement, the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many different ways in which we're standing up and saying everybody is a human who deserves respect and care and warm curiosity.
I'm wondering about, say, emotional warmth. If there's an incident of sexual harassment, that maybe there might be some sort of trauma or some sort of lacking in emotional warmth that either the man or the woman or both may have experienced in their lives.
Well, I certainly think that that's a part of this, because as soon as we move not just into warmth, but into warmth and precision, other people exist for us. And without those things, other people don't exist for us. If we think about, you know, the world movements of genocide, they have, the genocide inflictors have dehumanized the people that they're killing. They have to dehumanize them in order to make it possible to move into these, you know, very dark places that humans are capable of. So it's an interesting thing, because there's warmth and precision, but there's also, we need to take into account the human proclivity to create in-groups and out-groups. So the humans have a reward. There's a neurochemical reward for creating a group that we belong to and having other people be on the outside. We get rewarded by very powerful and feel-good brain chemicals when we do that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we need to wonder about when we're looking at the Me Too movement is to what extent the people who are creating the sexual harassment or sexual assault that happens, to what extent have they created an in-group, out-group where the other gender isn't even part of the in-group?
Mm.
So there are many questions here, I think.
Many
really
questions,
yeah.
So very, very interesting stuff, and I can see how your work could have relevance for, you know, for all of those issues that you've mentioned.
Yeah.
I want to ask you another question, which is, and then I'm going to turn it back over to Preeta for listeners who might have questions. But my question to you is, do you have a personal spiritual practice or personal self-awareness practice that you do today to keep yourself tuned and able to function with people in this way?
Oh, I have this sense that nonviolent communication is as Kit Miller, the director of the Gandhi Institute, says. She says that nonviolent communication is a spiritual practice masquerading as communication skills.
Aha! I like that.
Yeah. So there's a deep spiritual practice in being attentive to our language, and the work with relational neuroscience and the integration of that with language has taken me deeper and deeper into a self-love practice that has that centers around mindfulness meditation.
Beautiful. So at this point, we're getting close to the top of the hour, and Preeta, I'd like to turn it back over to you to see where we go with our listeners from here.
Wonderful. Thank you. What a fascinating conversation, Arya and Sarah. Thank you so much. So much richness in that. I have a number of questions, but we've gotten a fair number that have also come in through the web and through email. So I'm just going to remind listeners once again, if you have a question or a comment or a reflection, feel free to send an email to ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. You can also hit *6 on your phone if you're live and get into the queue. And you can also submit a question via the web form if you're listening to this via the webcast. So with that, I will defer my host prerogative with questions and turn it over to a caller in queue, and then hopefully we'll have some time to come back around to my questions. So let's see. Go ahead, please.
And Preeta, how long do we have for questions?
We have roughly a half hour, maybe a little less.
Great, thank you.
Hi. My name is Gayatri. I'm calling from India.
Hi.
Thanks, Sarah. This is, and Arya, this is just an amazing, amazing call. And I have a bunch of questions. I should also say that I'm doing Tom Bond's compassion course for the first time. So this is so resonant in some ways because I'm trying to learn how to practice NVC. So one question I have for sure is that, given that you say that we are resonant beings, how does one really kind of, resist or prevent being drawn into negative resonance? So if someone is angry or aggressive or great pain, how do you not let that pain or fear trigger your own pain or fear? And you remain centered, but you also don't close down, you don't, and I struggle with this so much, so I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. One is the more that we are supported in the experience of being sucked into others, the more we begin to exist as our own being. As you'll remember from my story about my mother, that it took several years. I mean, that was a big issue. That took several years of support before it spontaneously something very different came out of me in response to her distress. I stopped resonating with her distress and began to sort of have a solidity within myself. So some of what happens is a long-term commitment to supporting and understanding ourselves when we are swept away by other people's experience. And over time, we will find that we begin to exist more and more for ourselves and are able to hold on to who we really are when other people are experiencing distress or anger or overwhelming grief. We get to be with them. We get to resonate with them, but we do not lose ourselves. So some of it happens over the long term. Some of it can happen very quickly if we discover the deep needs that we have to join others. This is a nervous system to nervous system unconscious agreement that happens, where we have made this agreement usually with parents when we were very small, often before there were words, where we agreed to accompany our mother so that she would not be alone.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So once we understand that we are meeting a deep need of accompaniment, then we begin to have more choice.
Yeah, that is helpful. Do you also, so one has to, so I have another question actually, and this is, it's so funny for me because, you know, it's related to this conversation I was having with my mother. So when I joined the Compassion course, I also emailed my family, and my mother also joined, but she kind of struggles sometimes more with the words and, you know, really being like whether it's a viable practice. And we were having this conversation in the morning when she said, you know, you can't really love yourself. You can only receive it from someone else. This never makes sense to me. And she's like, no, you can only give it to someone else. Like, and it's so nascent for me. And, you know, it's still, I'm still trying that I just don't know how to respond to that really.
One of the, I don't know if your mother would enjoy hearing about the brain, but
yeah.
But if
so, I'm a scientist. I have a PhD, and all the time when I start going, she says, "Stop talking science." So
you can tell her, "Mom, you are in every cell of my prefrontal cortex." This is a quote from my favorite epigeneticist in Canada named Moshe Jeef. Mm-hmm. He says, mm-hmm. "Our mothers are in every cell of our prefrontal cortex." So we are carrying their love for us within us.
Mm-hmm.
And it teaches us to love ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if our mama, you know, wasn't loved herself.
Yeah.
Then, and sometimes we can be working with, you know, centuries of oppression. Where no one got to love themselves because everybody was, you know, just trying to survive in oppressive systems. We can acknowledge that if no one ever was able to love themselves, then they probably weren't able to give us that brain pattern. And mothers and daughters have the most replicated brain patterns of anyone. Mothers and sons don't have quite as replicated a brain pattern. Fathers and sons don't replicate the brain pattern as fully. But mothers and daughters, we inherit our mother's brains. And we have to heal and change them if in the movements that we make, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We have a question from Mish, who wrote in. She says, "Fascinating listen. Thank you so much." And I think this relates to a point you were making, Sarah, earlier on about the need to deeply root our compassion for others in the compassion we feel within our own bodies.
Yeah.
And she writes about, she says, "I believe strongly in the power of kindness. Kindness given, kindness received, that enables self-esteem, self-compassion. What are your thoughts on this?" And it kind of goes to a broader question that we in the service-based community often cope with or deal with, which is, you know, how do you both put energy out, and how does that lead to your own self-transformation? So, you know, this idea of you change yourself, then change the world, and to what extent does your efforts in the world also change yourself, the kind of Mobius strip of inner and outer action. So just curious about you.
Yeah, could you just quickly, her question, I got very involved in your statement there. What was her question again?
She says, "I strongly believe in the power of kindness. Kindness given, kindness received, which enables self-esteem, self-compassion." Your thoughts on this?
Okay, what I want to say here is that it's absolutely true. We carry any sweetness that has touched us. We carry within us, and it informs us and helps these brain fibers grow. When we receive kindness, then it's so organizing. If we can let ourselves feel it. So one of the issues here is for people who've not had any trustworthy interactions with humans, they may not be able to let themselves feel the kindness of others. So that's a nervous system contract within the self which stops this connection. So it's really important to know that if we can't feel others' kindness, it doesn't mean that we don't make sense. We still make sense. And we still get to find those deep needs and hold them with care and gradually allow ourselves to have the intention of letting ourselves be loved by humans. that we get to be loved, you know, that the people that love us get to be grouchy and unreasonable sometimes, and that we can still feel the love from them. It's quite an interesting intention and practice. And then the experience of kindness for others is so important. There is nothing that brings the world into a better place than the humility that comes from letting ourselves be a source for others, not from a place of elevation, but from a place of allyship and shoulder to shoulder. We are both humans. It creates inclusion and counteracts the natural tendency toward in-group, out-group, like nothing else. So it's such a beautiful combination, the inward and outward kindness. And Preeta, did I answer the question that you had, or the kind of, did I respond a little bit to your statement about the service-based community?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great.
We have a live question now from Wendy as well.
Okay, hello, Wendy.
Hi, thank you so much for this conversation, and it's quite interesting. And I can see, as you're talking about how much our presence and kindness can be meaningful to someone else, and I also just want to say I completely relate to being a woman with a round body and a mother who has a very tall, elegant body. It brought me back to my childhood when you were talking about that. But would you be able to describe a little bit more? You're talking about the emotional warmth and the precision. Could you describe a little bit more the precision end of the warmth and precision continuum?
Thank you for this question. The way that our brains and bodies are with emotion is that that we have experiences with our, it's almost like with our torso in the world in ways that we don't even realize. The fibers that run between torso and brain, 80 to 90% of them run from the torso up to the brain. So we are much more informed by our bodies in the world than we are informed by our brains deciding how we're going to be in the world. So part of what's happening that makes the precision important is that we need to have an understanding of our own emotional experience, which is accurate, which is clear and correct enough that our bodies say, yes, my message has been received. And this is precisely what is happening in those 4 months that Beatrice Beebe looks at, where the mother's facial expression catches both what kind of emotion is being expressed by the little one and the degree of emotion, the amount of intensity that is there for the little one. If the little one is a little bit angry and the mother makes a very angry face, it's hugely disorganizing for a baby. If the baby is very, very sad and the mother makes a tiny sad face that doesn't come close to the amount of intensity that the baby is experiencing, then the baby's nervous system has a shame response, an automatic shame response. There's a spike in cortisol, there's a decrease in endogenous opioids, there's a decrease in oxytocin. So we are needing, our bodies and brains and beings are needing to be understood. So, for example, if I'm sad and someone thinks I'm angry, that's a misunderstanding. There may be just as much warmth for them in their offering of their understanding of me. But if they do not have a precise comprehension, then I don't have a sense of being resonated with. Is this starting to make a little more sense?
Yes, I'm starting to get there where we really have to be precise in terms of our understanding and reflecting back to the other person their own experience.
Yeah.
Am I correct?
Yes, exactly. Okay. And we need to receive that ourselves, yes.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Wendy.
Thank you. Get to my question now, Kara. I wonder, you know, you talked so beautifully about how nonviolent communication in your early
experiences with that were really transformational for you and led to this, you know, long period of time where you were able to transform your relationship or the way in which your mother spoke with you.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, where did your interest in neuroscience come from? And
I like to know why things work. I was like, what happened? You know, I had this transformation. I was able to connect with my son. It was a miracle. And I'm not a person who goes, oh, it was a miracle, and then, you know, goes off and has lunch. I'm a person who goes, what the heck happened? So just coincidentally, at that moment in time, Matthew Lieberman, one of my favorite neuroscientists who works at UCLA, had just published a piece of research that he and his team had done, which was looking at the way in which the amygdala gets alarmed when it sees a facial expression. And then mm-hmm. once it names that facial expression, it calms. Mm-hmm. So inside and outside, when we are able to clearly and correctly name what we're seeing, and there's a congruence for us between words and experience, then there's a calming. And when I discovered that, I became so excited. I thought, oh, there is a way to think about what the heck happened. There mm-hmm. was something in this experience which allowed naming to be done, which had never happened before.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you mentioned that nonviolent communication is a form of spiritual practice. I think you said it was masquerading as a communication practice, which is a beautiful quote. In your own practice of that, you obviously bring this, you know, neuroscience interest and knowledge, and yet you're bridging the head with the heart. How are you able to kind of balance between, in a given moment when you're actually in the middle of a practice or in the middle of a situation, how do you balance the cerebral understanding, kind of your head-based understanding of what's happening, from the actual heart-based practice of nonviolent communication?
Well, one of the questions that I always like to ask myself is whether or not I know what's going on in my body. Because if I am in my left hemisphere, if I'm in my, I make a distinction between resonant language and instrumental language.
Mm-hmm.
So instrumental language is the language we use to get things done. What is our to-do list? Who do we need to respond to? What's the timing of everything that we need to do? How do we triage? What's prioritization? What do we want to tell people to do? What do we want to tell people not to do? How do we want to fix people? All this stuff is not body-based. It doesn't mm-hmm. have the contribution of the body. And when I'm in that instrumental kind of brain focus, there's no access to my body. So that's kind of the brain without the body. Mm-hmm. And when I say, for example, when I get really scared or worried, I lose a sense of my whole body existing. And so if I say to myself, am I reading my body? Is my body online? Is it contributing in this moment? If I can get it back online, then all of a sudden, brain and heart are connected.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That's fabulous. I'm going to turn it back to Arya because he has a couple of questions that are just jumping up.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. Hi. So let's see. There was one question. Yeah. Another question I had about your book, Sarah, was kind of an intriguing title in there. You talk about claiming anger's creative gifts. What are these creative gifts?
Yeah. Anger is such a beautiful and maligned emotion, mostly because we need to get the body involved in order to make it clean. By itself, it can revert to blame. It can, the left hemisphere by itself is not really very able to integrate new information. It integrates new information by figuring out who to blame. So there is a mourning component in every experience of anger. with anger, there is some way that something has not happened that we wish had happened.
Yeah.
And if we sidestep the mourning, which is a body-based experience, then we slip away from true relationality. But when we allow there to be mourning present, the difference is so startling. Why were you late? You don't care about me at all. You know, there's the anger, blame, you know, as opposed to, I was so distressed and upset when you were late because I'm so scared that I don't matter to you. Is a very different communication. And I am mourning that in this moment, somehow I was lost. You know, you didn't let me know what was going on. I didn't exist for you. And I am mourning that.
So the creative gift in that example is what? Is the self-awareness? Is the opportunity to connect with the other?
The opportunity to connect with the other, yes. And also, the gift here is so, so interesting. Anger lets us know that we exist. And so many of us don't actually have a sense that we exist and we matter. So when we realize, oh, I am angry because I had a sense that I didn't exist for my friend, then it tells us, I exist, my needs matter.
Does that, I noticed just personally that I'm angry a lot these days at the actions coming out of Washington, if I can just say it that way, of what's going on in the current administration government. I feel angry. So what do I do with that anger? I can get involved in a protest movement, or there's various things I can do. What's the gift of that kind of anger?
The gift is that the way that your values in the world matter.
Mm-hmm.
They are important. That your value on, there are so many things to choose from with this administration.
Right.
Your value on human lives, no matter where they come from, is key, is essential to you. That your care for the wild lands of North America is essential to you. Your anger is telling you how important these things are.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have one more question, Preeta. Is there time for me to ask another question?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, okay, here's another question. I can imagine, Sarah, the power of teaching these practices that you're speaking to us about to young children in schools. I can imagine lots of kids might have, you know, doors open for them, different kinds of lives. Are you involved with, are you aware of anyone who's interested in developing that kind of curriculum for school children?
There are people who have developed curriculum about the brain for school children. Daniel Siegel's been very involved with the Blue School in New York City creating brain curriculum for children. And then there are people in the nonviolent communication community who do nonviolent communication for educators. Sura Hart is one of the people who's at the forefront of that effort. So I haven't seen both of them come together yet, but I have great hopes.
Being interesting. Everything. Okay, thanks. Those are my extra couple of questions.
Wonderful. Sarah, I so resonated with what you were talking about with instrumental language versus resonant language. And I was reflecting to myself that sometimes when I get really caught up in so-called work and doing things that, you know, I'll let exercise go that day and other things, and the quality of the output is different when I'm not grounded in my body. So I really appreciated that. Yeah, great. Well, so we often like to ask our guests one final question, which is how can we
as a broader service-based community, we're an ecosystem of people in, you know, many continents around the globe. How can we support your work and your beautiful concepts?
Oh, well, for anyone who's interested in the work, there are free downloads of all of the meditations from the book on the website, yourresonantself.com. And so that's one way is to let their, you know, to begin to do these practices of self-warmth that are really radical in their, they change everything. They change social systems. Self-warmth changes social systems. Mm-hmm. Self-warmth changes immune systems. Self-warmth changes everything. To move towards self-warmth in any small way with meditation practices, there's a breath meditation that's the very first one on yourresonantself.com, and a good starting place for anyone who wants to become connected with this material.
That's beautiful. Well, I hate to put you on the spot, but we normally close with a moment of silence to reground ourselves.
Yeah,
but I'm wondering if maybe if you're comfortable and if you're prepared, whether you might lead us in a short self-warmth exercise.
Oh, thank you. So wonderful. Just notice, first of all, that you are a breathing being. And notice that you can tell that you're a breathing being. You can notice your breath, the way it feels. It might be in your upper sinuses. It might be in your chest. It might be the way your tummy moves. Wherever you find this sensation of breath, invite your attention to rest there. And if you are an experienced mindfulness meditator, then I invite you to bring a kind of glowing layer of warmth for yourself to cover your whole body. And let that, kind of hold that glowing layer of care for you around yourself as a part of your capacity to hold attention. And for those of you who do not do mindfulness meditation, your attention may have wandered away from your breath. Acknowledge your attention for whatever it's trying to bring you to, because it might be bringing you to a place in the body that hurts. Say, thank you, attention. I wonder if you would be willing for our long-term well-being to come back to the breath for just a moment. Wherever your attention goes, it's trying to take care of you. So thank it, and gently and with warmth, see if it is willing to come back to your breath. Yes, and now as we come to an ending, we'll just turn it back over to Preeta and let you take care of it here.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for your incredible articulation and combination of the head with the heart, your pursuit of that integration, so critical for the healing of our world. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the work you do, and thank you for sharing your morning with us.
Thank you very much. Arye.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.